Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello and welcome to Voices of the Sacred Feminine. Thanks for tuning in tonight, and hopefully every Wednesday or sometime afterwards as you listen to us from the archives. I know you're extremely busy. Your plate is full. You probably always have at least 10 plates spinning in the air. Probably some of you out there right now are cooking dinner, helping the kids with homework, washing clothes while you're listening. So thank you very much for your listener loyalty. That's the way of the world today. We, especially women, we're all wearing lots of hats trying to get the job done and make the world a better place and uplift and educate ourselves about everything that's been kept from us and swept beneath the sands of time and everything that's happening today that's sometimes hidden behind a smokescreen or maybe political rhetoric or religious dogma. The powers that be count on us not taking the time to look into things. But that's what Voices of the Sacred Feminine is about, giving people the platform to share important things, ideas, history, whether they're historical or herstorical or the news is in the current affairs of the day. Well, when you hear who our two guests are tonight, you'll realize that was a great lead-in. We have another outstanding double feature tonight, a dynamic duo, if you will. Our first guest up in just a couple minutes here is Donna Woolfolk Cross, author of the book Pope Joan. She's going to be talking about her book and the times in which that courageous woman who felt forced to go through life as a man to be educated found herself and how she duped the Vatican doing it. Then at about 7:15 to 7:45, we have a special last-minute guest coming on the show. If you're a goddess advocate, a feminist, a social activist, you'll recognize her name. It's Rhianne Eisler, author of Chalice and the Blade, The Partnership Way, and The Real Wealth of Nations. She's with us tonight discussing her work in the world, of course, but particularly her upcoming appearance in Orange, California this Saturday at Chapman University, where her keynote talk will be What's Good for Women is Good for the World. And I plan to be there, and I hope you are too. So if you're a listener and you see me, please come by and say hello. But before we get to our guest tonight, just a bit of housekeeping. I want to always show gratitude for our wonderful guests and for our new listeners because we add new family to Voices of the Sacred Feminine every week. So let me just quickly explain how all this works best. So you don't miss any great shows, might I suggest to you that you go to Blog Talk and click on the Follow Me button on my show page so that you never miss the weekly show. You'll get reminders of who my guests are, and when life gets busy, you stay in the loop and know what's going on, and you're aware of what goddess advocates are talking about at the water cooler this week. And more important, you won't miss anything provocative or enlightening that my wonderful guests impart to listeners with each passing week. And while you're there, please mark the show a favorite. And as always, my thanks to all my listeners, new and old, because you are truly the gas in my tank. You know, many of you out there have called this show a treasure trove, maybe even the best goddess show on the airwaves. And I thank you for that. It's obviously, as you might expect, music to my ears to know what I'm doing is making a difference to you and you think this is valuable. And, you know, when I get an email from someone in some little town, maybe in some red state, who feels totally isolated, alone, and they tell me this show is their lifeline, well, you know, those messages, those I consider those gifts from Goddess herself, keeping me here with you every week, bringing you stuff I think you might like to hear, or maybe you have to hear. So thank you very much for your loyal listenership and being a part of our Voices of the Sacred Feminine family, and I'm truly glad you value what we have to say. And if you're listening live and want to call in to talk to either of my fabulous guests tonight or myself, the number is 718-766-4662. I know most of you listen from the archives, but if you want to call in, when I see you on the switchboard, get to a good stopping point, I'll come to you and invite you to give your comment or question. I'll identify you by your area code. And finally, tuned in till the end of the show because I'll be making some important announcements, including news of the Gaia Festival in Santa Barbara in November, where I'll be giving a presentation on the Sacred Feminine for a Sustainable Future. I'll give you news of some of my important upcoming guests like Sister Joan Chittister and Dr. Vandana Shiva. And finally, my tour to Turkey for women and men in November 2011, a website is now up, only a few days now. The tour is called On the Trail of the Great Goddess of Anatolia, Anatolia, which means Land of the Nourishing Mothers. And we're taking only 20 people, women and men, so if you're interested, it's best to stake your claim to a seat on the tour as soon as you can. All right, so now let's turn our attention to our first guest, Donna Woolfolk-Cross. Let me tell you a little bit about Donna, and then we'll start what I think is going to be a really interesting chat. Donna graduated cum laude at Phi Beta Kappa from the University of Pennsylvania in 1969 with a BA in English. She moved to London, England after graduation. She worked as an editorial assistant for a small publishing house on Fleet Street. I believe it was called W.H. Allen & Company. When she came back to the U.S., she worked at Young and Rubicam, a Madison Avenue advertising firm, before going on to graduate school at UCLA. And when she was there, she earned a master's degree in literature and writing. In 73, Donna moved with her husband to New York, where she began teaching writing in a college English department, and so now writing is her full-time career. She's the author of two books on language. One is called Word Abuse, How the Words We Use Us, and Media Speak, How Television Makes Up Your Mind. Oh, I got to ask you about Fox News with that title. She is the co-author of Speaking of Words and Daddy's Little Girl. She's the product of 7 years of research. The product of 7 years of research and writing. Pope Joan is her first novel, and it's a very good book and a very good movie. She's now at work on a new novel set in the 17th century in France. So if you'd like to know more about Donna and Pope Joan, let me make sure I mention the website in case we forget later on. You can go to popejoan.com, real simple, and you can learn more about Donna and the movie and the book and screenings and all sorts of good stuff like that. So that's just simply popejoan.com. So Donna, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Gang. It's good to be here.
Well, you know, I so enjoyed seeing the movie before the FBI pulled it off the internet.
I think I was the FBI.
Well, you know, I'm
not supposed to be out there yet.
Well, you know, I saw it. You know, it was just divine guidance or something. You know, if there's such a thing in these cases, I saw it the day before it got pulled off the internet. And if I had waited one more day, I'd have been out of luck, you know. So I felt so lucky because it was an incredible, incredible movie. So tell me, how did you first start to get interested in this character, Pope Joan, who I'm sure you're going to tell us you believe is a real person? And then how did the book turn into a movie? I mean, how did that all fall into place?
Well, wow, that's a lot of question in one sentence. Like, you're obviously experienced at this, my dear. I'll try to, if I forget any part of it along the way, let me remind me.
Okay.
But, you know, as you said, I had written some different, very different books, nonfiction books, humorous books, actually, about words and language, born of my time, which you also mentioned to your readers, working in advertising on Madison Avenue, writing toilet paper commercials for the greater good of humankind. I do hope everyone listening appreciates what I contributed to the forward march of civilization there. But in any case, what you know, I learned from working in advertising, it was interesting and eye-opening for me because it did teach me how a skilled wordsmith can manipulate, can deceive, can make you think you heard things that were, in fact, never actually said.
Uh-huh.
And that led to these two word books you mentioned, Word Abuse and Media Speak, which was a look at how various professions, doctors, lawyers, advertisers, obviously, politicians and others, artfully use words.
Could you lend your expertise to the Democrats?
I often think, I really do, I'm going, why can't you do better than this?
I know.
It bothers me. They can't spin things, I'm telling you. But
I know.
No, I hear you, Karen. I truly hear you. I don't know why they can, because there's a lot frankly, of spin, manipulation, and outright deceit going on the other side.
Oh, for
and
sure.
There should be a way to counter that, frankly, but I don't hear a lot of good countering. But in any case, that did lead to my word books. And now each time I wrote one of those word books, you know, it would make just enough money that a publisher would say, write another one, and that's all nice, but I am here to tell everyone that, well, you're just never going to be able to retire by writing word books. So, particularly since not only their only audience are people interested in words, of course, but also sales, quite frankly, are restricted entirely to English-speaking countries, because I'm writing about the English language, which in my case pretty much meant the U.S. and Canada.
So,
Pope Joan, by contrast, is in 36 different languages.
So, in other words, what you're saying is it doesn't translate well, what you're writing in those books.
Right.
Okay.
Just what you were saying. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. You're exactly right. It's connotations and nuance and, you know, that definitely does not translate from one language to another.
It's just like when one country doesn't understand other countries' jokes, you know.
I think it was Cervantes who said that translation is the opposite side of a tapestry. Meaning, you know, there's the front side of the tapestry, and it's all beautiful, and all the figures are fine. Then you turn it over in the back, and you see all the loose threads and the knots and completed things. So, you know, really, once you speak other languages, and I do, and I'm sure you do, many people do, you realize it's not a matter of word-to-word correspondence.
Right.
There are some words that simply don't exist in English that do exist in other languages, and vice versa, English words that simply have no perfect translation.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're in trouble with religion in some senses because, you know, of how things were translated.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's a way of looking at the world, really.
Yeah.
It's like a house. A language is like a house with a certain limited number of windows and doors. And the words we have in it, that's what lets us look out of those windows and doors. But other languages have their windows and doors placed in other positions.
Right.
So they see the world a little differently. And that's why I do think, I wish, frankly, we taught languages earlier and more in the United States because I think it would also teach us a broader worldview and more tolerance.
Oh, but, you know, we're here on, you know, we're isolated by these two oceans. We don't have to worry about the rest of the world. That
seems to be so much of the mentality out there, you know. Absolutely. We can drive for 2 weeks in one direction and still be in the United States. So. Absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
But how did Pope Joan, I mean, was she headed there? Yes, what happened
is that after my last word book, having discussed just the kinds of interesting issues you and I couldn't resist right now, because it is an interesting topic, but having written the last of them, it was in fact my daughter who suggested to me that I might want to try to write the kind of book that she knows I most enjoy reading. And she knows that what I love to read, you know, really my idea of a, oh, good, look at this nice, fat book I have to curl up with tonight, is carefully researched, well-written historical fiction. Because the way I see it, you know, when historical fiction is done well, boy, you really get the best of two worlds. You know, you get all the normal fun we get of a, I'll turn out the light in another 5 minutes or five more because I just can't put this book down yet.
Mm-hmm.
And you learn so much.
Mm-hmm.
You learn history the way it's never taught in school, not those boring details, the dates and the names of battles and lists of kings, but the you are there history.
Mm-hmm.
So as in, if I'd lived back then, what food would I have eaten? What wine would I have drunk? What god would I have worshipped?
Well, it helps us reimagine. It helps us reimagine it.
It does. It's time travel, really, is what it is.
Yeah.
And I'd be fascinated by it. It's the closest, at least, I think I'll ever be able to come to time travel. So I love the genre. And my daughter said, well, instead of writing these word books, which, while mildly profitable, were obviously never going to be much of anything, why don't you try writing historical fiction for exactly the reason you just said? You know, it has all those wonderful aspects, time travel aspects to it, and I love it. So I was mulling that idea over, wondering if I could, in fact, make the leap, the very large leap, by the way, I have insights into this now, between nonfiction and fiction. two very different genres, when in fact I stumbled across Pope Joan's story in a passing reference. Actually, it was a book in French, which I was reading to keep up my skills in French, and it was a reference to Le Pape Jeanne, which means, of course, Pope Joan. I thought at first that was a typo. I remember thinking, what a hilarious thing to write, Pope Joan. That's a funny mistake. They must have meant to write Le Pape Jean, Pope John. But, you know, a couple of weeks later, my daughter had an assignment for school. That required her to go to the library. She was, in fact, at that point, too young to drive herself still, so I had to take her. By the way, that daughter of mine is now a veterinarian, so you see how long it took me to write this freaking book.
But, wow, what a long gestation.
It was a long, long time. But, well, she was off in the library, and she was doing whatever research she had to do. I had time to kill, so I wandered over to the New Catholic Encyclopedia, you know, just to have a look-see. What was that weird passing reference to a Pope Joan? You know, not expecting, of course, to find anything at all. But when there was an entry for her in the New Catholic Encyclopedia, I tell you, Karen, I stood in that library with my jaw dropped open. I couldn't believe it. Could not believe that a story, which, you know, even that unsympathetic source, obviously, New Catholic Encyclopedia isn't sympathetic, but nevertheless, it mentions all the very important people who've written about Joan, Petrarch, Boccaccio, Plotina, papal librarian to, you know, several popes. And I'm reading this and going, are you kidding me? All this has been going on for centuries, and I haven't even heard about it.
Doesn't it just make you so mad?
Well, actually, at that point, it was more like a lightning strike. I mean, I think I knew right then at that moment, wow, this is the topic for my historical fiction. I thought then, hey, I still think that it's what they call in the book business a drop-dead story. I couldn't believe I'd had the enormous good fortune to stumble across it.
Wow. So, all right, so how many years then did it take you to actually write the book?
Well, I admit to 7, but it actually took a little longer than that. But keep in mind how embarrassing this is. It's so embarrassing, Karen, because, you know, all my other books I'd written in a much more normal year and a half or two. And here I am working endlessly on this thing. And all the time I live in a real world where I have, for example, friends who are saying things to me like, when will the book be done? When will the book be done?
I am perfecting it.
I had started to call it my posthumous work because I did think I might end before it did. But it was, you know, I really had to teach myself a lot. This was serious. This story is set in the 9th century.
Well, also too, you're gonna, you know, you are also trying, you know, whether purposefully or not, to prove that someone existed who many people or institutions would rather say didn't. So you had to, you had to make sure you got all your facts right, so that, you know, one little trivial mistake here or there, somebody couldn't use to discredit the whole premise.
Well, yes and no. I mean, the no part is, of course, that this is not a treatise. This is not actually nonfiction, an argument in favor of her existence. Though I do make one in the author's note at the end. You want to keep in mind, this is fiction. This is a novel. I wrote a novel.
Mm-hmm.
What happens, of course, is that Joan's story is told.
Right.
There are over 500 ancient chronicle accounts that contain her story. But it's told just like those of all of the other 8th, 9th, and 10th century popes, in this very skeletal form. You want to remember this is centuries before printed books, so that all of these chronicle records are being scratched out with uncertain ink on nubbly animal skin. I mean, that's what parchment is, it's animal skin. And so they weren't going into what you'd call a lot of detail. They were getting down the basics. So what if you could pluck Joan's story off that handwritten page and put it into modern print, it would, just like the stories of all of the other 8th, 9th, and 10th century popes, it wouldn't take up any more than about 20 pages.
Right.
So I knew, of course, from the get-go that what I was going to do, what I in fact wanted to do, was to take this skeleton of a story, this wonderful and I think inspiring skeleton of a story, and put flesh on it. You know, give it laughter, smiles, tears, the things that make a story human. So the book is not, in fact, an argument for her existence. It can be enjoyed whether you believe her to be legend or truth. But at the end, as I say, I do have this author's note that puts forth evidence that I think many of your listeners might find startling in favor of her existence, and I'm certainly not the only one who's made that argument.
Well, I'm convinced she's real.
I'm so glad I am too. But
you know, I, and if and maybe it doesn't take a lot to convince me, but the chair. The chair convinced me she was, you know, if nothing else. I mean, why would you need a chair like that unless it was a chamber pot? And it wasn't
well,
a chamber
you know,
pot
I need a
chair.
I'm so glad you said that because, you know, I had to spend $1,000 of my own money to put that in that book.
Are you serious?
Because, yes, my publisher was too cheap to put it in. But I think it's very convincing. And, of course, your readers probably have no idea what we're talking about.
No. So you should probably explain.
You should explain, absolutely. Now, this is not, you know, this is... The chair, while very interesting, let me preface it by saying it's not proof of Joan's existence, but it's a very interesting and intriguing piece of circumstantial evidence. And what it is it refers to, indeed, the chair, the piece of furniture that was used for centuries, starting at the end of the 9th century, after Joan would have reigned as pope, if in fact the story is true, then she reigned as pope in the 9th century disguised as a man, only discovered to everyone's horror upon her death, to have been a woman. And starting at the end of the 9th century, right up until the 16th century, this particular chair was used at a very sacred moment of the papal coronation ceremony. Now, those who have the book, or you've mentioned how struck you were by the picture, because in fact, the minute you see this chair, one is sort of astonished to learn that this was used in a papal coronation ceremony, because it's so obviously a toilet seat. I mean, it just there's no mistaking it. You know, that's it. Now, the interesting part about that chair is that there is, in fact, no debate. There's no controversy over it. The church itself admits this was the chair that was used during the ceremony. It stands to this day in the Vatican Museum. You know, you can see it. So the chair itself, not controversial. Where interesting debate comes in is about the reason why so bizarre a piece of furniture would be used. The official explanation being that the chair is made of a lovely porphyry marble, which is true, it is. And because of the loveliness of the marble, the fact that it had this large toilet seat hole in the middle of it was merely incidental. No one really noticed. One way or the other, they just like the marble. Now, again,
Joan, please indulge me just a second here.
But I'm Donna, right?
I'm sorry. got Joan on the brain. That makes, maybe we're channeling her here. That makes about as much sense as the church telling people that black Madonnas are from candle soot. You know, excuse me, but it's another one of those absurdities that they try to make people swallow. But anyway, go ahead.
It is hard when you see the chair. That's why I'm glad you said, you know, those who do buy my novel and read can see the picture of it in the back in the author's note. It is hard to believe no one noticed it because it's right there. And the other explanation, which is supported, by the way, by several of the chronicle records, and at least three separate eyewitness accounts of a papal coronation ceremony between the 9th and the 16th century, say that there was a reason for the chair being shaped like that, and that is that after Joan would have reigned as pope again in 9th century, and everyone's horrified that in the end, oh gosh, she was a woman, every newly elected pope would have to sit on that chair with his robes spread, and the youngest of the deacons would come forward, reach up into that hole in the chair. It's a public airwaves. I've got to phrase this very politely. Let me see how I want to put this. Make test of the Pope's manhood. How about that? That's polite enough, but at the same time descriptive enough.
And then
the deacon would announce to the gathered crowd, our Pope, our new Lord, is a man. Now, that's a mighty weird custom if there was never a female pope.
I know. It's like it just begs for you not to, have any critical thinking, to just buy that just suddenly that became part of the ceremony for no good reason. You know, that all have to be, some sort of sexual deviance otherwise, So what would you rather choose?
Glad I'm not having to argue that position. But, again, as I say, it's circumstantial evidence. Much more powerful, I think, is, as I say, the over 500 ancient chronicle records that exist for Joan, which is, by the way, so substantially more than we have for King Arthur. Almost all Americans believe in King Arthur, even though the truth is the evidence for Arthur's existence is scant,
right?
Almost to the vanishing point.
Right.
I mean, if the man lived at all, then he was a warlord by the name of Ambrosianus who might have fought at some battle of Mount Baden. We're not sure.
Well, some people say it was a composite of several people
the real story that we like, that we love, that we treasure, I too treasure it, comes from, a writer 600 years later, Geoffrey of Monmouth, wildly imaginative, who then brings in stories of a round table and a sword in the stone, and Lancelot and Guinevere, they all appear over 600 years later. And, by the way, Geoffrey of Monmouth says that he bases this record of his on a book called Lives of the Kings of England that nobody but he ever saw. Now, imagine if Joan's story hung on so slim a reed of evidence.
Uh-huh.
He would have laughed out of the room. But here we have Arthur's story, which does hang on that slim reed, but which every school child knows, which has been repeated and retold so often, it feels like history to us.
Absolutely.
I mean, when I tell people this, I feel bad because I see the disappointment, and I feel like I'm telling them there's no Easter Bunny or something. Because we all believe in, King Arthur, and gosh, it is a wonderful and an instructive story that has much to tell us about Celtic Christianity and chivalry, knights and ladies, great story. Now, Joan's story, by comparison, as I say, over 500 ancient records, some by some of the most important people in the Catholic Church, highly placed men, men deeply devoted to the papal see. So what motive they would have to make up such a story, we don't even know. But her story, by contrast to Arthur's, has not only not been promoted, it's been extinguished, ignored, erased, expunged, to the point where most Americans haven't even heard of her.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is proof of what the 17th century philosopher Francis Bacon said, which is, people believe what they prefer to be true.
God, we're seeing that here in the United States.
Exactly.
So, all right, so a couple questions. All right, so you and I pretty much believed Pope Joan was real for all the reasons we said. All right, and I want to know how the book ended up a movie, but I also want, what I want to talk about is what the times were like then for a woman that would have made somebody like Joan have to go through life as a man mm-hmm. in order just to get an education. I really want to talk about that Christian history that would have made, that forced her into doing that almost. I guess at least that's the way I sort of look at it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's the great question, of course. As I say, my book is a novel, so we don't know for sure what her motives were. We know a lot of what she did, but not her motives. But I couldn't agree with you more. In my novel, the answer to that very important question of why would she do this? Why would she give up her gender identity, live all alone, take such risk? For to have been discovered would have been to suffer the most horrible of deaths. They had inventive ways of killing people. Back in the 9th century, her death would have taken weeks of slow torture had she been discovered. So, why would a woman do this is a novelist's question, as a matter of fact. It's the one I set out to answer. I love your insight. I, too, agree that the answer lay in the times and in the options that were available for women back then, because the 9th century was, in fact, a very misogynistic age, informed by a lot of anti-female diatribes on the part of church fathers, some of which I, you know, include in the book. You know, you are Eve, you are the gate of sin, you are the reason why Christ had to die, et cetera, et cetera. Would have been hard, actually, to have self-esteem as a woman, I think, in the 9th century.
Well,
but,
you know, the way the book opens, I just have to tell you, the movie, I'm sorry, well, and I know the movie follows the book. When you're showing her being birthed into the world and what her mother went through, at, you know, at her this callous father, who, you know, or husband, I'm sorry, who just said, well, if she dies, she dies, it's God's will. You know, it's like I wanted to just throw things at the television.
That's funny. And yes, but those were, you know, I took all of those statements and all things right off the page of 9th century writing. You know, menstrual blood back then was believed to make iron rust, to infect dog bites with incurable poison, to make crops barren. Women could not enter a church for 30 days after they'd given birth. They were considered to be unclean. Make that 60 days, by the way, if it was a girl child to whom they'd given birth. Rape was considered a minor crime, far less serious than taking a man's cow or anything like that. And by law, women could be beaten by their husbands. The only law in the books was one regulating the size of the club that the husband or the father could use on these women. And above all, and this is what ties in more clearly to what you were saying, learning in women was absolutely discouraged. For a learned woman was considered to be not only unnatural, but actually dangerous. One of the theories of the day, for example, was that the size of a woman's brain and of her uterus were inversely proportionate. Which means, of course, the more a woman learned, the less likely she would ever bear children. Now, Karen, I hear you laughing. And I mean, it wasn't ridiculous today, but indeed. But, you know, in a way, I hate all the parts of this misogynistic philosophy, of course. But I do, this idea of a learning making you less fertile sort of charms me in a way, because it's occurred to me that if that were only true, you do realize you would have no trouble at all with birth control, right?
I know.
I mean,
oh,
you don't want to
wonderful.
Have a baby. Yeah, don't want to have a baby, read a book. Read a Bible. You'll get a library card, and you will never have to worry about birth control at all.
That is hysterical.
So, I know. It's, in some ways, it's delicious. Alas, it is not true, as we know. And unfortunately, even more unfortunate, it led to, you know, a great deal of oppression on the part of women. Now, the idea is, you know, Joan is described in all of the chronicle records as brilliant, as a prodigy of learning, sort of like Mozart was a prodigy of music. Joan was a prodigy of learning, the smartest person of her day, with an overarching intellect. Now imagine this, such a woman, in such a time, what option did she have, I ask you, if
right.
she wanted in any way to exercise her goddess-given qualities of mind and heart and spirit? Other than to have disguised herself as a man. She would not have had an alternative. And it's so interesting you ask me this question now, Karen, because I, any of your listeners ever read the New York Times, then within this past week, just this, I can't say the exact day, but I'm guessing last Thursday, because I was reading the New York Times while I was on the plane traveling somewhere, there was a front page article about young Afghani girls. Do not think for one moment this is limited to Christianity. It was an interesting article about young Afghani girls who are disguising themselves as boys so that they can go to school, so that they can get jobs and support their families, so that they can escort their sisters in the street, because, of course, girls cannot be out without a male relative. And they do this with the permission, the consent, and the encouragement of their parents. And there was a picture of three young girls in this New York Times article, three sisters, two, and they're all almost about the same age, two dressed as girls, and the other one is dressed as a boy. And
wow. Well, you know what what it makes me think of, too? It just hit me. With the Barbara Streisand movie, Yentl.
Mm-hmm.
you know?
Absolutely, which is also based on a true story. Yeah.
So, okay, so question. All right, and again, we don't know the motivation. We can only speculate. We think she did this so that she could get an education.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I know the answer, but let me see what you think, what your opinion is. I just keep thinking, if you're her, and you are, you know, you're taught that in this religion that surrounds you, that, you know, you are second-class citizen, to educate you is blasphemous, you know, all of this misogyny.
Mm-hmm.
I almost wonder, why didn't she just run away from the church and get an education somewhere else? Or were there maybe no other options?
That's what's going to say, and where would you suggest she get that education in the night?
Well, I don't know. You know, I'm not an expert on the time, so
maybe there
were no other options?
You bet. This is long before the era, for example. Sometimes readers will ask me, well, why not a nunnery or something, you know? But this is 9th century. This is pre-Middle Ages. You know, this is not – the 9th century was really a very degraded time, stuck between two civilizations, between the Roman civilization – which fell, you know, Rome fell in 476 A.D., which a date I always find amusing, by the way, because it does not reflect the seamless way in which we living, you know, we experience the world when we're living it. It's not like, you know, one day in 476 A.D., the Romans looked at each other and went, my God, we just fell. This is terrible. You know, I mean, it didn't happen like that. But it's not a bad date to use because it pretty much signaled the end of the socioeconomic structure that we think of as the Roman Empire. And yet, the socioeconomic structure that would be Middle Ages, feudalism, you know, we know it as, had not yet started. So this was a really bad time to live. I mean, I have friends who play the lottery, you know, and I always say to them, stop it. Stop doing that right now because you've already won it. You've won it big time. By living now, by living here, you're living better than 99.99999% of human beings have ever lived. And that's particularly true when you go back to the 9th century. So this is even before the time of the great nunnery. She couldn't have gone to a convent. There were places sort of called convents, they were actually called monasteries back then, where families would put their unwanted and unmarriageable daughters. But they were very secular, and many babies were being born in those places, and there was no study at all.
Right.
And, you know, really,
well, now we know the church, when the movie came out in Italy, I think I read on your website somewhere that the Vatican, you know, sort of went, you know, freaked out a little bit, and that just helped the sale of the, you know, at the theaters. Or is this so controversial for them because it exposes the ugly Christian history, or their embarrassment at being duped, or all of the above, or?
All very good guesses. I mean, you're obviously so knowledgeable. I will, first of all, tell you the details of what happened. Is the movie first opened, it had its premiere last October, actually, in Germany, where it was the number one film for 3 months. Even beating out, I'm proud to say, Michael Jackson's This Is It. and it's also opened in other countries, you know, Belgium, France, Japan, Mexico. And I'm in a fight now, actually, to bring it to the U.S., which is why there are some screenings coming up. But it did just open in Italy, as you say, about 3 months ago. And I think it was sort of languishing there, to tell you the truth. I think it was like, you know, around number 10, nothing much happening, until, just as you say, someone in the Vatican was so infinitely foolish as to condemn the film, as to say, do not see that film, do not see that bad and evil film, or you're going straight to hell, the result of which was, of course, to turn it into the number one box office film the very next day.
So why are you having so much trouble getting it shown here in the United States?
Well, I think we should go to that second because you had such an interesting other, and I wanted to answer that question.
Okay.
I can't remember what was it, though. I went off on Italy, and now
is it an embarrassment for them that they were duped, or does it expose their ugly history?
Okay, very. See, thank you for, well, at least one of us can keep track of the conversation. Thank you so much, Karen. I think it's deeper than that, I have to say, and ties in so much to the wonderful theme of your wonderful show. And that is deep-rooted attitudes about women in the church. And, in fact, to be fair, not only in the Christian church, but also in Islam and also in Orthodox Judaism. The whole Judeo-Christian thing has a lot of misogyny built into it. In the case in particular here with Joan, you want to understand how much rested on this whole idea of papal infallibility. You know, popes have to be infallible. They're not men. They are divinely guided by God and therefore can't be wrong. And it was, in fact, this very issue, breaking with this very issue, that Martin Luther, you know, cleft the Christian world in two. Protestantism really is a revolt against the series of very bad Renaissance popes. The Medicis and the Borgias were a pretty bad lot. And the whole raging debate then was, you know, is the Pope, again, as I say, infallible? Now, this is why absolutely the Church cannot admit that there was ever a woman Pope, because according to the theology, women are inherently fallible. We are Eve. We are the portal of sin. We are imperfect men. Back particularly in the 9th century and throughout many centuries afterwards, it was considered, you know, if you were a particularly wonderful woman, lived a sainted life, I mean, you're, I don't know, Mother Teresa back in the 9th century, her reward in heaven when she died would have been to be reformed as a man. And thus perfected. Yes, but I'm not kidding you. So you
I know.
Where the argument would be lost there. The argument would be lost immediately. If you admit there was a woman pope, then absolutely no argument anymore. Obviously, popes are fallible because women are fallible. And that's why I think her story is so dangerous.
I see. I didn't think about that, but that makes perfect, perfect sense.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect sense.
Yeah.
All right, and so so let's go to the you know, why you're having trouble getting this distributed in the United States, because it's obviously a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful movie.
Oh, it is a wonderful movie. And listen, I'm, for those listening who are just tuning in or whatever, you know, I'm the author of the novel on which the movie was made. I didn't write the movie, I didn't write the screenplay. So I ask you, how often do you hear the writer say they love the film based on her novel?
Right.
I mean, I think it's a fine film, and I am disappointed that up until now it hasn't opened in the U.S., but I'm fighting hard. The movie is opening in film festivals around the country and just won a wonderful award. In fact, you just mentioned it's the Gaia Award for Best Feature Film at the Moondance Film Festival, and I'm hoping that'll bring attention. I have to say that I think the distributors, the company handling distribution, I think they decided even in advance that this story wouldn't have an appeal in the United States. I know they're wrong because I know about my, you know, hundreds of thousands of readers and how much they'd like to see it. I think it's timely for the reasons we talked about, particularly since women in places like Afghanistan and Pakistan and Algeria are fighting the same exact fight that Joan did over 1,000 years ago. For the simple right to learn and thus empower themselves, because learning is empowerment. I think that's a wrong guess, but on the other hand, you know, if that's their opinion, then obviously they start out thinking that, and then it tends to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. So I'm setting out to prove them wrong by showing how we can fill theaters with interested people, and that, in fact, there is appeal in this country and interest in this country for this story.
Well, you know, I'm glad you're being tenacious. And, you know, ever since I found out about this, I've been doing everything possible to help you promote it.
You've been so supportive, Karen. You knew about this story very early, actually, even before the movie.
Oh, did I really? Okay, I thought I came into this late. But anyway, you know, and this is just my opinion, but I wonder if that is their public reason for not distributing it, that, you know, they're not thinking there's interest. Because I don't know if I told you, but the movie Agora, that other European-made film that's sort
of... another wonderful woman, Hypatia. Yeah.
Yeah, another wonderful woman who, you know, is not treated very well by Christianity. Mm-hmm. You know, they came
And very smart, by the way. Notice it's her smart intelligence that gets her in trouble.
Yes, again, there you go. You know, I was at the Q&A in Los Angeles after it had a special screening here, and they just came out and said they were afraid of the Christian backlash. And I really thought the same thing with this, because, I mean, let's face it, You know, I don't think most Christians know their history. You know, I really don't. And just like all the goddess stuff and the sacred feminine stuff and, you know, all the misogyny, I think they just assume people not see that.
Well, it's possible, but I mean, the movie was number one in Italy, for heaven's sakes, with the Pope right next door.
I know.
So, I mean, I don't know. And keep in mind, it's a little different from Hypatia because, of course, she was, I don't know how you would call it, a Christian, let's put it that way. Not
yeah, she was
Christian.
Pagan. She was pagan, really.
So, of course, that's a whole different issue. Whereas, you know, in our country, where a lot of the religious, a lot of religion is, you know, Southern-based Baptist or Protestant,
mm-hmm.
And they don't care what the popes do.
Well, yeah, I guess you're probably right. You know, I'm just looking at both of them from the standpoint of it makes Christianity look really bad, and you know, and maybe
why?
That's just something they, you know, I mean, because in Agora, I mean, you know, you saw the, you know, the violence, the ignorance, the,
mm-hmm.
You know, the intolerance of Christianity. It was ugly, bloodthirsty. Mm-hmm. It was terrible, you know. And I remember when Dan Brown's book came out, you know, The Da Vinci Code, all the truth squads that they mm-hmm. felt, you know, they had to put together, that in some cases they were really, you know, sort of dispelling history, you know. You know, and with Agora, you were having, you know, the few releases that did get around the country, you had, you know, religious leaders feeling like they had to try to, you know, put it down, again, using faulty history, you know, saying things that weren't true to just sort of discredit the movie. So I think it was, you know, I think it's an embarrassment. But you know what, I guess I look at it from the standpoint is, okay, so if it's an embarrassment, we face it, we move on, we rise above it, you know. We don't keep perpetuating ideas that hold women down, that are still misogynistic.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I just don't think they want to, you know, I think they just want to keep it under wraps. I don't know.
Possible. I mean, I try not to be any more paranoid than normal, but I'm not sure I'm quite there yet. But on the other hand, look how many embarrassing moments in our own history that we have been willing to make films about. And this isn't an embarrassment. I might say I have trouble understanding why this is such a horror for the church. I mean, maybe for Catholics if you still believe in the infallibility of the Pope for reasons already mentioned, but why for Christians in general? You know, all the chronicle records say that Joan was actually a very good Pope.
She was
a good and wise Pope.
But she was a woman.
Little, I never thought I'd get you to say something like that, Karen. That's really great. You're very good at arguing the other point of view.
Well, you know, I have to, you know, just share with you that, you know, I've had some arguments with women over both of these movies, because, and sometimes in cases they have been Christian women
mm-hmm.
who really, and I mean, I guess maybe this is where I get the idea that they don't want to look at it, because I still run into Christian women every day that are in denial about the misogyny of the contemporary church,
mm-hmm.
you know, that don't want to look at how the Bible gives license to, you know, make women second-class citizens, or, you know, all of the stuff that, you know, people who still take the Bible literally say and believe and do, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I just really think there's still a lot of denial out there. And, you know, and I remember one woman who's a respected leader, I asked her once, you know, I said, well, when you realize that, you know, we weren't getting the straight story, were you angry? And she said, oh, no, I was sad. And I thought to myself, ugh, you know, I just wanted to shake her, you know. Maybe if, you know, if we could change things, you know, if, you know, shake things up a little bit so there would be a little bit more, you know, parity and equality, if we just, you know, looked at things and were honest about what we're seeing and what happened instead of trying to paint a rosy picture, you know. I don't know. I guess I just
no,
don't
I'm
like
totally
to
in agreement. I think you actually expressed that very well and very eloquently. Of course, we both agree with each other, and who knows what listeners are there. But, you know, I do think that, Well, what is the old saying? A man can, let's say a woman convinced against her will is of the same opinion still. You know, so, and now, obviously, everyone, and I'm fully in support of that, everyone has a right to their own opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't have a right to your own facts.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is, there was a Hypatia.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there you can make an argument either way about Joan, but I think the weight of evidence on the side of her living. But I agree with you. I don't see the value in cleaning up history. As you say, painting a rosy picture of history. Some people have even said in my novel, because, you know, there are tough scenes to take. There's a Viking
mm-hmm.
raid on the town of Dorstad. Everyone's there, and it's historical. Everyone's there in their little church. Imagine this. Imagine the fragility of life then. There you are on a Sunday in your little village church worshiping, and all of a sudden the back doors break open, and in come Vikings, Norsemen, and kill everybody. Wow, talk about life
growing
mm-hmm. on a knife edge, you know.
Right.
And now people have said, well, that's kind of violent. And I go, I know, but it happened.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me, same thing, I really insisted that my daughter, my then young daughter, go see Schindler's List when it came out. Not an easy film to see, you
mm-hmm.
know, about the Holocaust. Tough film. She was like 16 or 17. And she did go to see it, and yes, it was hard to watch. But, you know, my feeling is, just as you said, Karen, that if these people could live these things, if they could endure these things, then the least that the rest of us owe them, the rest of us living in our comfort right now and our ease and our freedom from famine and pain and disease and really war on this continent, the least we owe them is to bear witness that these things happened. Because, indeed, I do believe with Santayana that those who do not study history are doomed to repeat it.
Or shall we say those who rewrite history will force us to repeat it.
Yeah, oh boy, you're good. That is, I wish I had a pen. I would take that one down. That's very good.
Well, okay, so let's talk about, I would hope that, you know, listeners everywhere are going to want to see the movie, read the book. They definitely need to get the book and see the chair in the back and read all your author notes. I was just intrigued by all of that, which you won't get in the movie. How does one go about trying to get a screening in their city? And I know there are some screenings coming up in Tacoma, in Los Angeles, San Francisco. But if you're not lucky enough to live in these blue states,
mm-hmm.
how do you get an underground copy so you can show it in the basement and not have your neighbors come firebomb your house?
Well, I hope people are not going to get underground copies quite yet, because I am still in, I have to tell you, the fight of my life right now to still get it a wide release. And if it simply becomes an underground copy that everyone's already seen, that's the end of that.
Oh, well, I'm sorry. You know, I didn't actually mean it like that. I meant get a, you know, however you arrange to do a screening. And
yes.
I was just sort of, you know, I was being bad. I was mocking.
No, you were being,
I was acting as if they had to hide that they were showing it, you know, because it's like something, you know, that you know, their neighbors might, you know, think
right.
was horrible or something.
Like an illegal drug or something.
Yes,
you
know? Yes.
Well, actually, I do think the best thing to do, and I was grateful you mentioned the website, which is, in fact, popejoan.com. Pope Joan's all one word, all small letters, real easy. Go to popejoan.com. And one of the best things you can do, actually, is on the homepage there of popejoan.com, this little thing says, do you want to get updates? And anyone who wants to, if they give me their email address, I will add them to my once-a-month newsletter that I send out. Once a month if I'm good. Sometimes I take 2 months, but I try to get one out once a month. And the one that just went out actually had a lot of information about the various film festivals and their contact info, and some other good information, too, about things that one can do if you want to see the film in your area. So I would suggest that. I'm going to, in fact, you know, I only wrote this newsletter maybe 2 weeks ago, and I will, anyone who signs up in the next couple of weeks, I'll make sure they get that, and I will keep them updated about progress and tell them what action actually can be taken. It doesn't hurt. See, for example, the film was just shown at the Moondance Film Festival in Boulder, where it won the Gaia Award, as I say, for Best Feature Film, and that's good. That gets noticed, and hopefully it'll keep winning awards and coming to attention. At some point, there's a sort of irresistible momentum. I'm trying to get some momentum here.
Now, now a few things. If someone can arrange a screening in their city, does it cost them anything to get a copy of the film?
If it's an individual, it certainly would. I mean, yes.
I don't know how this all works.
Well, I'm not a film person. Keep in mind, you're talking to a novelist here. But
okay,
from what I've learned, from what I can tell, you know, Constantine Film, who is the studio producer, you know, they have to be good about this, and they have been good to me. I'm the one who's been submitting to all these film festivals, and they have indulged me because we did work well together. And in fact, I was creative consultant on the film. I didn't write the screenplay, but I was very engaged in it and very involved in it. And they certainly took a lot of my suggestions and ideas. So we have a good relationship, and I think partly for that reason, when I do manage to get the film in a film festival, they will arrange to send it out. But it does cost them something, and it all depends in which form it's sent. I mean, if you can just send a DVD, that's obviously a lot easier than if they have to send a 35-millimeter whatever, which I think is the way it may be being shown in Los Angeles and San Francisco. It's costly for that. It's not real costly, but I mean it's like $300 or $400, and so I don't think they do it unless they find good and urgent reason, but I'm trying to create that good and urgent reason. I'm trying to prove, as I did, by the way, for the book. I fought years for this novel because the publisher did nothing to promote it. And the way it stays in print to this day is because I chat with book reading groups all over the United States and Canada 2 to 3 times a week every week.
Wow.
And what that means is, you know, if a book group happens to choose Pope Joan, which I hope they do because there's a lot of interesting discussion topics to be had around that, then if they wish, they can again go to popejoan.com, and there's a place there you click that says book reading groups. Tell me the night they're meeting, and if they wish, I will call in at my own expense and chat with them by speakerphone, answer whatever questions they might have about the novel, you know, which characters are real, which are fictional, what really happened, how did the movie go? Whatever they want to know, basically. Except my weight, which I never reveal.
Except your rate, which you never
reveal. My weight.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I tell anybody anything except my weight.
Well, you know, I do have a couple questions about the story, but let me ask, this first. You know, you were talking about you thought what happened, maybe wasn't so much embarrassment by the church or hiding an ugly history, but it was just this deep misogyny that's not only in Christianity, but, you know, in other, you know, the Judeo-Christian religions. Where do you think that comes from? I mean, I don't know if it's a chicken or the egg question. You know, was it before the Bible or after the Bible in the story of Eve and all of that? I mean, don't you think it goes back even before the Bible?
Well, yes, of course, you know, you get back to sometimes pre-history. I mean, we only have the written history, but certainly it goes back to Old Testament. Certainly, as I said, I think it is a thread that runs through all of Judeo-Christian culture, which includes Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. I don't have an answer. I mean, I'm no guru. I'm just a novelist here who tried to write a good story. Frankly, above all, what we might be missing is, I hope, this novel of mine. It's just a rip-roaring good story, you know, which is why it was turned into a film. But so don't take my words as coming from on high. I'm just making the guess here that there are certain economic reasons even, I mean, that I can see that are advantageous to keeping women powerless. Whoever said, you know, follow the money, basically, are useful to have unpaid labor in your home, raising your children and doing the laundry and taking care of life, the business of life, which women
always.
Well,
I was thinking too, if it's true, you know, if you believe any parts of feminist theology, and if you think that in, you know, the first divinity was female, and by association, you know, women had a preferred status because they too were life givers, maybe it was just a gender war. You know,
well, you obviously know the book When God Was a Woman, and you
right,
know, yeah. So
to turn the table.
Certainly, there was
know.
A sea change. There was a sea change there, but I can see where. And again, this is just my guess. There is no better way to keep any social group powerless. It doesn't have to just be women. It can be a racial group. It can be a religious group. There is no better way for any society to keep any group powerless than to deprive them of their right to education.
Right.
And, I mean, there's a quote from our own president, James Madison, I've always loved, and he wrote, "Knowledge will forever govern ignorance." And those people who mean to be their own governors must arm themselves with the power of knowledge.
Mm.
See, this is what I love about Joan's story. This is what she did.
Absolutely.
In this time of incredible misogyny, all set up against learning and women, she armed herself with
Absolutely.
The power of knowledge and went on to become one of the most powerful and influential women who ever lived. I think her story is very, very inspirational, and
she had
my own daughter in mind when I wrote it.
She is a heroine. We have a caller. Let me see if sometimes the people at the show on the switchboard are just listening, but sometimes they do have a question.
Okay.
So I'm going to go to the caller with the 818 area code and unmute you, caller.
Hey,
hello. Good afternoon. Hi, caller. Did you have a question?
Hi, I just wanted to comment that doctrine of women are fallible is very much alive today. I would know. I was raised severely Christian, and I do say that severely. There is a website that you might want to thank. It's called No Longer Quivering, which talks about the effects of that sort of indoctrination that is very much alive today, very much alive. And this film is a godsend. A goddess sense. It is very much needed. It is very much needed. I will go and I will take as many women as I can see it the moment it shows up anywhere around my area.
Well, you have an 818 area code, so you're here in Los Angeles area?
Yes.
Well, it is going to be showing in Santa Monica on October, it's on my calendar.
22nd.
October 22nd.
Yep. At the Aero Theater in Santa Monica.
Well, I am definitely going, and I'm bringing, like I said, as many women as I can, because it is paramount. It is the concept of women's failure and fallibility and the portrayal of sin and the reason why. It is not something of the 9th century. It is well and alive right here, right now, in America.
I couldn't agree more. I thank you for expressing it so well. I do believe, just like you, that Joan's story, while a very ancient one, remember, this is over a millennium old, 1,200 years, very long time ago, and yet, despite its ancientness, it is strangely new and deeply relevant to the world we inhabit today. I agree.
I agree with me. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, caller. Thank you very much. Well, Donna, we probably have maybe 10 minutes here, maybe 15, depending on when my other guest comes in.
Sure.
What would you like to do with these last few minutes? Did you want to talk about the changes that were made between page and screen, or how Catholics have been responding to the story? What do you want to talk about?
I can do both of those. I'm always happy to follow wherever you go. Let me speak to the Catholic response, I guess, because you mentioned that. As I mentioned, the book is in 36 different languages, different countries, that really means. And often what happens, is when the book appears in a different country, they'll bring me over to do book signings in the bookstores, that sort of thing. And I tell you now, this might surprise you, Karen, that I have signed more copies of this book to nuns all over the world.
Wow.
And you might imagine. And I remember the first time I did it, thinking, this is interesting. I was writing, for Sister Mary Agnes with best wishes, going, I don't think I expected this moment. But in fact, now that I've done it so often, it makes enormous sense to me that it is precisely these women of faith who live within the church, who love the church, who have so much to offer the church, who understand, perhaps better than anyone else can, the full import of Joan's story. So the response I've actually had from individual Catholics has been warmly welcoming to a degree I didn't expect. I've been very accepting and very welcoming. From the Vatican itself, you know, apart from the movie, and we talked about that earlier when the movie opened in Italy, but from the Vatican itself, there's been nothing but a great silence. But, you know what, in the weird world we inhabit, the mad, mad world we live in, if you want to know the very best thing that could possibly happen to me right now, it would be to wake up tomorrow morning to learn that the Vatican has banned my book. Because, I mean, you can't pay. You really can't pay for that kind of publicity. And the day after, in fact, anyone in the Vatican is so foolish as to condemn the book, it will, in fact, be on the New York Times bestseller list. And the book has never been on a bestseller list of any kind in this country. It has in many others. But here again, I haven't had a publisher who's ever really promoted it, so many people don't even know about it. And I put it to you that, frankly, the best way to bury any story is to ignore it. There is no better way, as, in fact, Joan's 1,200-year-old story proves.
Well, two questions about the story. Number one, I don't know. I don't think by saying this it ruins things for anyone.
Oh, don't tell the ending. Don't tell the ending. No,
okay.
Don't ruin it. Don't do it.
Okay. All right. Well,
I will simply say to those who may be listening, who may have read the novel or know the story, that I did not make up that ending. I wouldn't dare.
Okay.
Comes straight from the Chronicle records. And,
okay.
But
that
I would
answers my question.
Don't actually discuss it, except to say that she, you know, Joan does die a premature and violent death. But other than that, I would rather not comment, except to say, indeed, the ending is from history.
Okay. So can and if I'm getting too close here, just say no.
Okay.
the way they show you in the movie she died, do you think that's really how she died?
Yeah. I mean, either she lived and died like that, or she didn't live. I mean, that's what the Chronicle accounts say about her. And by the way, I would simply mention that, you know, she died a public death. Certainly we
right.
can say that. And it's very important that that be true, because you realize had she died, she was disguised as a man, of course. Everyone believed her to be a man. Had she died behind the walls of the Papal Palace, no one would ever have known she was a woman, right?
Right, right.
So public death was required. And for those, by the way, who say impossible for a woman to disguise herself as a man in so public a role and maintain that disguise for 2.5 years, that's supposed to be the length of her papacy, and nobody knew, and to say it cannot be done, I refer you to the at least 10 books that have been written on this very interesting phenomenon of female cross-dressers, female transvestites. Turns out we're actually very good at this disguise. We've been pulling it off with enormous success throughout history. There are legions of women who have done this, some in very public positions, just like Joan's, and in much tougher conditions.
Mm-hmm.
You want to remember, Joan, living in the 9th century, had some distinct advantages. For one thing, all clothes were just like big, loose potato sacks,
right?
Sometimes belted, sometimes not. That's not just clerical robes. That's all clothes. Personal hygiene was non-existent. You know, people washed their hands, their face, and their feet, but they did not bathe. No bathing.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I think it was probably aromatic to live in the 9th century, but there you go. And, of course, the body was considered a sinful vessel, not to be looked at, touched, discussed, not anybody else's and not your own. So all of these things would have been very helpful to a woman attempting male disguise in the 9th century. The women, the over 400 women who fought in our own civil war, that's both sides, north and south, disguised as men, had a much tougher job, right? They had to wear uniforms. Those are far less body disguising. They had to sleep in the field or in tents right next to men. Obvious toilet issues arise, and I don't have an answer to them, except maybe behind a tree.
Mm-hmm.
All that we know is they did it. And again, in the author's note that's in the back of my novel, I mentioned some very startling examples of modern women, even, who have done it, including one did it in about 2004 or something. She disguised herself as a man, wrote an interesting book, by the way, called Self-Made Man, for a year. She was disguised as a man for a year, and for 3 months she went and lived in a monastery, and nobody knew.
Hmm.
So it can, in fact, be done. It has been done. And I think that the interesting question about Joan's story isn't how did she do this, but the one you mentioned, Karen, and I think the good one, which is why. Mm-hmm. Why did she do it? Because that's the one that continues to speak, as your good caller just said. It's the one that continues to speak to women today and has relevance for women today.
Now, how much, did you use creative license for her lover? Was that totally made up, or was there, well?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, her lover, she does, we can mention at least this much. She does, according to history, get pregnant, so obviously there had to be a lover. Played, by the way, in the film by the adorable Australian actor, David Wenham, who played Faramir in Lord of the Rings, a man who looks, I swear, like he got up off the pages of my novel and walked onto that movie set. just a delicious man and actor, perfect for the part. We knew that there was someone who impregnated her. Now, all that the Chronicle records tell us is that that person was her familiarus. That's the Latin word, familiarus. And that Latin word can be translated into English in one of two ways, either to mean bedroom chamberlain or to mean close associate. So it was my job as a writer of historical fiction to make the best guess I could, given the evidence we had at hand. And knowing everything I did about the woman and about her time, it simply made no sense to me that a woman who had come so far, who had risked so much, would have just tossed it all aside, because one day she takes a look at her bedroom chamberlain and thinks, hey, you know, boy, he's hot, let's jump his bones. I mean, in other words, I couldn't work this out to be a casual sexual encounter. It made no sense at all. So I decided to follow the other interpretation of familiarus, that of close associate. As you know, I have a linguistic background. My previous books were in linguistics, so I did some linguistic research, and given its 9th century context, in fact, that's what the word familiarus meant. It meant close associate. And then, following fundamental principles of narrative fiction writing, I intensified that. So it became a lifelong relationship of mind and heart and spirit, not just flesh. That is where the, I'm so sorry to say, entirely fictional character of Gerald comes from. And I say sorry to say it because I tell you, Karen, I've had more than one reader ask me for Gerald's phone number. to which I always reply, boy, I wish I had it myself. But in any case, he is one of the fictional characters. As I say, that's what historical fiction means.
Right,
you take
right.
The structure of history. I had every detail of food and wars and clothing and all of that dead accurate. It took me years to make it so. But then you must make some imaginative leaps.
Well, and I'm also thinking, too, how, you know, getting back to Joan as a person, how conflicted she must have been.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a split second in the movie where she's maybe going to leave it all, you know, and then in the next 5 minutes that totally changes. And, of course, well, we don't know if that happened, but she had to be conflicted. I mean, I would think, how could she not be?
And very alone. And very alone. You know, there's a stage production being mounted of it actually in Germany, going to open in June of next year in Germany. And I went over for the press conference, and it was thrilling. It's a musical production, which may sound funny at first, but I remind you that they took Victor Hugo's Les Miserables and were able to turn that into a musical. So It can be done. And this one I think is going to be very good, because they brought in the woman who will play the part, who's the major musical theater star in Germany. And she stood there on the little stage and sang one of the songs that's completed. Yeah, I don't speak German, but so those who do, please forgive me for murdering your language, but basically it was called Ich bin allein, I am alone.
Okay.
Because indeed you are alone inside that male disguise. With whom can you share that? No one.
Well, and I'm thinking, too, how conflicted she must have been going, you know, pretending to go through life as a man. And I think you sort of allude to this in the movie a little bit, too. You wonder if she didn't yearn to be a mother. Now, I mean, all of us women, I mean, I know I'm one. I'm childless by choice. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you wonder if that was also another conflict for her, you know, that the life she chose was going to make it very difficult for her to have children.
Well, certainly.
Yeah,
and, you know,
yeah.
That is a loss. And in my novel, she makes it clear that is a loss.
Right.
You know, she
right.
sees a young daughter in particular. I know how I love my own. I can't imagine life without my daughter. Can she see such a young girl and feels with a pang all that she is required to give up, you know,
right.
all that she will not have. On the other hand, you can have that, but then she also would never have had what she became, would never
yeah.
have had, as I say, full exercise of her formidable qualities. So, yes, it was a very tough situation to be in, and it remains so. I remind everyone listening, it remains so for
Absolutely.
Women all over the world today. That article in the New York Times I mentioned about the young Afghani girls disguising themselves as boys.
Yes.
Wow, the sacrifices are intense.
And well,
the conflict once they about whether or not they're going to return to be women is intense.
Well, I'm sure we can probably find that in the New York Times archives. I'm going to look for that tomorrow.
It's in the last week, as I say. I'm betting Thursday because it was a travel day and I was reading it. But I'm not off by more than one day.
Okay. No. Well, Donna, it's time for me to regretfully say goodbye. But I want to thank you so very much. You have just been wonderful. And the Pope Jones story is just so intriguing and, as you say, so relevant still today for so many women just across the globe. So thank you so much for your tenacity. And if there is anything I can ever do to help you get the word out, I am there for you. I'm one of your foot soldiers.
I think you've already done a great deal, Karen. And I'm grateful. It's for me to thank you for such an intelligent and interesting interview. All the good questions asked and the feelings expressed so well.
Well,
we are in agreement,
you.
My dear. So thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you so too, and I so hope you have luck with a wider distribution, because you know what, I feel like I'm not going to sleep until everybody in the United States gets to see Pope Joan.
And you are a one woman army, I'm sure. So.
All right,
thank you so much, Karen. Enjoy the rest of the show.
Good night.
Good night.
Well, listeners, that was Donna Woolcroft. You know, I always get her name mixed up. I want to just call her Pope Joan. Donna Woolcroft, and she is the author of Pope Joan. And we're so lucky to have her bringing the life and times of this courageous, tenacious, and gutsy woman, Pope Joan, into our awareness. But our next guest is here at the switchboard, and I want to say hello to her in just one second here. Rhianne, is that you?
Yes, it is.
Well, thank you so very much for calling in tonight. I introduced you at the top of the hour, and I told our listeners that you were going to be with us for a while. So welcome once again to Voices of the Sacred Feminine.
Well, thank you.
Well, you are about ready to, you know, head down this way and be at Chapman University on Saturday. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that upcoming event in your keynote talk?
Well, my theme is going to be what I so often, if not call it, use as a title, but it's one of the themes of my research and of all my books. You know, from The Chalice and the Blade all the way now to my latest book, The Real Wealth of Nations, that what's good for women is good for the world, and what's bad for women is bad for the world. And what, of course, as you know, my research and my writing does, it really not only puts a face to that, but offers some facts, some empirical evidence, such as studies that we have done at the Center for Partnership Studies, as well as studies that are beginning to appear, including even the World Economic Forum's gender gap studies, showing that where the status of women is higher, the general quality of life for everyone is higher. Now, it's up to us to get that message out. You know, I couldn't help thinking as I was listening to the end, because I came in just before the end of your last guest, when you were talking about having to pretend to disguise yourself to be a man in order to have a position of influence. Well, we are, thank goodness, at a place right now where we're beginning to have a foothold in positions of leadership. And that's one of the reasons that I teach, by the way, at the California Institute of Integral Studies, an online class on transformative leadership. Women working with enlightened men, this is our time, and it's urgent for us to change not only the conversation about what are the issues and how can we solve the challenges, but the solutions. And one of the major solutions is worldwide raising the status of women.
Well, Rianne, what would you say to, you know, when you obviously have Q&A this Saturday, no doubt a woman is going to say to you, okay, Rianne, you know, I don't have the platform that you have, what can the average woman do to try to make a difference, to do her part?
Well, there is so much we can do. Of course, none of us can do everything, but all of us have a possibility to do something in our sphere of influence. For example, at the Center for Partnership Studies, we have a program that is a training program so that people can become leaders, conversation leaders, to change the conversation about economics. And indeed, as a matter of fact, in addition, for those who are, and I hope many people will want to come in person because that's really fun when we're together. And by the way, this event on Saturday at Chapman College, I'm not just going to be speaking. I mean, people are going to be sitting at tables and networking with each other and sharing and, yes, making action plans. But to get back to our training, I'm also doing a webinar on the 5th. Which is on Wednesday of next week, and you can find, and it's free, and you can find information about it at our website, which is partnershipway.org.
Okay.
Now, if you want some specifics of what we can do, I certainly want to give you some examples. Every one of us can really, when people, the policies that we want, for example, that we so need, policies that invest in our real wealth. You know, in my book, The Real Wealth of Nations, I bring out something that once you say it seems obvious, that the real wealth of a nation, indeed of the world, isn't financial. I mean, we saw that with the melting overnight, right, of these derivatives, of the credit swaps. It consists of the contributions of people and of nature. So once we really start with a realistic premise about what economics can and must do, we also then see that we have to become involved in changing, first of all, the conversation about economics to show that caring for people starting in early childhood and, yes, caring for our natural environment are not only essential in terms of the return on investment that they give in human terms, in environmental terms, but in purely financial terms. So we have, for example, on our website, and there will be handouts, of course, at the event on Saturday, on the return on investment, supporting, investing in caring for children. And it's a huge return of investment. And people, when they say, well, we can't afford it, it's our job to say we can't afford not to invest in it. Not only because of the savings, just in money, in prisons, in court costs, in lost human potential, but because as we now move into really what politicians should start talking about, into the knowledge information age, the most important thing for us as a nation is to invest in human capacity development, and we're not doing it. And that investment has to start with early childhood education and parenting education. And yes, we have to give much more visibility and value to the stereotypical women's work of caring for people, caring for children, whether it's done by a woman or a man.
Well, Rhian, let me ask you, and I guess this is sort of a, you know, I mean, we're talking about socio-political stuff here. It feels like to me, at least, that the rhetoric that you, that's at least seems the loudest, I don't know if it's the majority, but it seems the loudest, is this survival of the fittest. If you're not making it, you're not working hard enough. This idea that we can't help one another because, you know, that's somehow bad in socialism. How do we counter that, you know, that seeming selfish, you know, there's not enough pieces of the pie kind of attitude that seems to be permeating the dialogue out there?
Well, look, the problem is not really just one of explaining to people that actually in the course of evolution, if we hadn't developed caring behavior, if we hadn't developed helpful behavior, none of us would be here. I mean, starting with the mother-child, the parent-child, right? I mean, we have to help one another. And indeed, if you really look at evolution and get away from the emphasis of social biology and evolutionary psychology on the negatives, you see that we have just as much of a need and capacity, and even more so, for caring, for empathy, for creativity. And that's what really has made it possible for us as a species to survive. So it's really, reality has been stood on its head by so many of the stories that we've been taught about, quote, human nature, whether it's the story of original sin or whether it's the story of selfish genes running us. It's the same story. We're bad, so we have to be controlled, right, from the top. And of course, those who are in control in families, which is traditionally in the, what I call domination systems that we've inherited, been the male head of household, or whether it's in the tribe or the state, which usually also, you know, women weren't supposed to do that sort of thing, they have the right to control us. And it's all for the good. Well, this is nonsense. We've got to change the stories. And a lot of my work is really about more realistic, more empirically based, more truthful stories about human nature. This said, you bring up socialism. Well, the truth of the matter is that when we're talking about capitalism versus socialism and socialism versus capitalism, we're stuck in an old, useless conversation. Because if you really know your economic models, your economic history, you realize that neither capitalism nor socialism, for example, have been able to avoid our environmental problems. In the former Soviet Union, in China, socialism became a domination system, didn't it, of top-down control.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to really move beyond that old, tired argument, maintain the positive partnership elements of both capitalism and socialism. You know, if we really had a free market, which we don't happen to have with all of these huge multinational conglomerates, I mean, it's ridiculous to talk of a free market, isn't it?
Yeah.
But if we had a free market, that would be good, but it wouldn't be enough. We also need central planning, government policies. And my poster children for the success of this and the success of using the best elements of both but going further to what I call a caring economics are the Nordic nations, Sweden, Finland, Norway, which, by the way, not coincidentally, these are the nations where women are 40% of the national legislatures. And yes, they got there through quotas, and there's nothing wrong with that, because when you have a situation where people have been kept out and people have been brainwashed to think that women can't be leaders, you've got to do something to enact legislation. I mean, Brown versus Board of Education was really an official act of saying, hey, we've got to integrate, right?
Right. Right,
I mean,
right.
The government has to take a hand in this. But, you know, these nations were very, very poor at the beginning of the 20th century, so poor that whole states, Minnesota, got populated by people fleeing famines. But they invested in caring for their people, in human capacity development, and, yes, in the women's, quote-unquote, work of caring for children. And today, because they have paid parental leave for both women, for both fathers and mothers very generously, they have stipends for families that to help them care for children. They have elder care with dignity. They're not ideal, but people lead much less stressful and better lives. They have less poverty. And by the way, they have a very large segment of the population that are women-headed families, and yet these are not poor families. So when people tell you, oh, as they're beginning to again, you know, it's the woman-headed family nonsense, it's bad social policies, uncaring, and really short-sighted and totally irrational social policies. These nations today rank in the top ranks, not only of the United Nations Human Development Reports, but in the World Economic Forum's Global Competitiveness Reports. In fact, they're ahead of the United States. So what can I say? You know, it's up to us to bring this information out. And every one of us can use our handouts, use my book, The Real Wealth of Nations, become transformative leaders. And it's so exciting once we do.
Well, I think we need some of our own politicians, you know, because it seems like the left and these sorts of ideas that are generally associated on the left, they're just silent, you know, or petrified of suggesting these sorts of ideas because, you know, because the other side is going to, you know, act like, oh, Europe is evil and, you know, we don't want to be like Europe, you know, even though
yeah,
they're so much better
off
than
Europe.
We are.
We don't want higher lifespans. We don't want less crime. We don't want less poverty. Unfortunately, our politicians don't have this information, a lot of them. And they have let what I call the regressives, because I don't like this liberal conservative thing or left-right thing, because frankly there are people on the left who are just as blind to the fact that what's good for women is good for the world as the people on the right, okay?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I mean, let's just be very real about this. So part of our job is to talk to the people who consider themselves liberals, who consider themselves a progressive, and say, wait a minute, you know, here's the elephant in the room.
Right.
Take a look at the information, and not only take a look at it, but get your politicians, I mean, if they would just start talking this way during this election.
Right. Oh, what a
difference it could make. What a difference it could make when people say that socialism, you say, no, these are caring policies, and look at how successful they can be. And we want to really adopt the best policies. That is the American way. And it's un-American not to invest in our people. And if you want to use the term, invest in our human capital. I mean,
well, yeah, that would be a good, I think that would be a good catchphrase.
Well, that's the phrase economists use. I'm not in love with it, but on the other hand, it registers.
Yeah, it does. It makes perfect sense, and it's hard to, I think, dispute it, you know. Well, two things I want to ask you is it would seem to me with the structure that they already have in place, maybe there's a flaw in this thinking, but if there were a way to get, more progressive churches maybe even on board with these ideas. But it even seems like, even though Jesus is teachings were about, you know, loving one another and, you know, feeding the poor and, you know, when he walked with women and all of this, you know, sort of like the first feminist in a way, it would seem like they would be the perfect people to try to get on board to try to help with this. Or is that sort of skewed thinking?
I don't think so. When The Chalice and the Blade first came out, a lot of church groups did reading groups. There was and there's still many people in the spiritual community who have been influenced by that book, which basically, you know, showed, I mean, the subtitle is Our History, Our Future, looked cross-culturally, looked historically at the configuration of what I call a partnership rather than domination system, and again, the status of women was one of the key ignored elements. And because along with the status of women as a real predictor of quality of life, of course, also is the situation of children. I mean, there's so much fascinating information that our policymakers could be using, but, you know, we've let the regressives frame the conversation, and we can't afford it. So I would say an election is coming up. Use this material. Get to the politicians that you want elected and get them to use this language. But even beyond that, go and really put the ones that you don't want elected on the spot by framing the conversation in terms of caring, caring economics. What are they going to say? I mean, if you show how economically successful these policies are, if you tell them study after study shows that the best investment a nation can make is in high-quality early childhood education, the stuff that's being slashed right, left, and center, I mean, we're not going to be competitive in the post-industrial knowledge information economy. Let them deal with that issue.
Well, look, you're preaching to the choir here, and I totally, I totally agree. But I can just hear the other side. You know, they want smaller government. I also read an article that said one of the reasons these ideas that work in Scandinavia won't work here in the United States is because we're sort of this mongrel nation where, you know, we don't have this united identity. So there's some people that, you know, don't want their tax dollars to maybe go to people with a different color skin or a
idea. The Scandinavian, the Nordic nations send more money to the so-called developing world proportionately than any other nation. This is nonsense. It is that they have a more caring ethos, and one of the reasons is that the status of women is higher. And when the status of women is higher, men no longer find it such a threat to their masculinity, to their status, if you will, to embrace more stereotypically feminine values. I mean, if we reframe the conversation here, we have the power now. We have money. Many of the women in this country have money. Many of the women in this country have organizations. We just need to change the way that the conversation is held. And that's why it's so important. What I really want to invite your listeners, our listeners, to really think of themselves as people who are going to be in the forefront of transforming the culture, of transforming, because if you don't do that, then the conversation is always the same, isn't it? Small government. They got to be kidding about small government. They have nothing against government in terms of huge armies or huge prisons. I mean,
right.
You know, that just expose them.
Yeah, they're just
go
selective about
meeting.
What they're willing to spend their money on. They don't want to invest money in people. You know,
it's also because the caring is stereotypically feminine work, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so, you know, controlling, you know, fighting,
dominating,
that's supposed to be male, you know, masculinity, which is nonsense. So look, it's not going to happen unless we show up at political meetings and on both sides.
Absolutely.
And start talking about this. Send emails. Talk to people in the Obama administration who desperately need a new language.
Well, yeah, they've lost their voice.
Well, I mean, because they're using the same old voice.
Yeah.
Instead of changing the conversation.
Well, Rianne, we need to send you to Washington. We need to get you in front of Congress.
Well, we have a Washington office, and one of the things that we're doing, by the way, is working to change the indicators of economic success from gross domestic product to really include the enormous economic value of the work of caring and caregiving. And people may say, well, it can't be quantified. Well, it is being quantified. I just give you one example, which is that the Swiss did a what they call a satellite report, and they found that the unpaid household work would be 70% of the Swiss reported GDP. And look, for us to talk about balancing life and work, if we don't get these policies, I mean, in our day-to-day life, is absolutely unrealistic. Again, I mean, you can schedule and you can do whatever you want, but if there isn't paid parental leave, if there isn't flex time, if there aren't stipends to help with childcare, you know that in Montreal, childcare costs $7 a day, and you know what? Childcare workers are highly trained, and you know why? And they're well paid because the government subsidizes it. And they're looking ahead
at being
economically competitive, for goodness sakes.
Well, you know, we really have to change what the idea of family values means. You know, right now it's just a charade. It just doesn't feel like it means much of anything. And so often it's exposed to be hypocrisy. But what we're talking about really is quality of life, a caring culture, valuing our women, our children, so that, you know, we have hope for the future.
But it's also talking about economic success. And by the way, I use the phrase valuing families rather than family values.
Okay.
Because that's really what we need to do. We need to value families by all of these kinds of policies. And people will say we don't have money. Of course we have money. It's a question of priorities. Would we rather put it into prisons? And, I mean, it's absurd.
Or give oil companies subsidies, or give corporations that outsource jobs tax credits.
Whole thing is backward. But you see, we really need to be vocal, and we need this new language. And I really invite people, go to partnershipway.org, come to the event. I mean, I think it's going to be lots of fun. I've talked to some of the people who are going to be doing the interactive part, and it's going to be great. Attend our webinar. Read The Real Wealth of Nations. Start a real, you know, just like churches started, study groups on our website. You have materials for study and action groups using The Real Wealth of Nations. I mean, we have to educate ourselves, and then we can go forth.
And I think your webinar is coming up on Tuesday.
It's on Wednesday. My event in Chapman College is on Saturday, all afternoon, and it's going to be great. And then the webinar is on the 5th, Wednesday the 5th, and you can register, by the way, by just going to partnershipway.org.
Okay.
So tell your friends, too.
Well, Rianne, thank you so very much for coming on the show and giving us a sneak preview of Saturday and your webinar and what you have been, you know, just tenaciously and diligently been out there in the world, you know, trying to, you know, change perceptions and, you know, trying to, you know, do like the Dalai Lama said, you know, it's up to us Western women to change the world. And, you know, with your ideas, I mean, we have something to work with. So, I so honor and believe in what you're doing.
Well, and I'll also be talking about myself and my life on Saturday. Because when we have a group of women getting together, that's what we always do.
Well, and we're storytellers. We're sharers.
We're storytellers, yes. So I'm looking forward to seeing many of our listeners at the event and to seeing you there too, Karen.
I will absolutely be there. I'm going to be one of the facilitators at one of the tables. So.
Oh, you are? Well,
yeah.
Fun.
So I'm looking forward to it.
Well, listen, it's been, as always, great to talk with you. There's so much to say, and but more than that, we have a window of opportunity as women working with enlightened men. Let's use it. Let's do it.
Absolutely. I'm with you. Well, thank you, Rianne. Thank you very much, and I look forward to seeing you Saturday, and I'm going to be in attendance at your webinar next week as well. So
great.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Good night.
Good night. Well, listeners, that sound means that we're crossing a threshold into the next part of the evening, and that's actually our closing. I hope you've been enjoying our two guests tonight. At first, we had Donna Wolf Oak-Cross, author of Pope Joan, which inspired the movie of the same name. I believe we were really lucky to have her bring the life and times of this courageous and tenacious and gutsy woman, Pope Joan, into our awareness. And, you know, as we said, you know, that her story is so relevant today. And Rianne Eisler, one of my most important mentors. Her book, Chalice and the Blade, literally changed the direction of my life. I can't wait to see her Saturday at Chapman University and let everyone out there, you know, hear what she's been up to and the recommendations she has on, you know, how we have to, you know, be accountable and actually do what we can, each of us individually, to try to help shift our world into a better direction. If you're interested in that event by chance and you're saying, well, how can I attend? You can either go to Rianne's website, partnership Center for Partnership Studies, or if you want to email me, I am before Saturday, I'm happy to connect you up as well. I'm not able to put my fingers on the exact web addresses and everything at the moment, but you know how to reach me, and once you reach me, I can forward your email to where it needs to go. So let's see. We have about 10 or 15 minutes left here, so let me make those announcements that I promised at the top of the hour. I would love you to know about Gaia Fest. That's coming up in November. In Santa Barbara. Gaia Fest is an event that has been happening for a few years now, and I'm happy to say I'm on the board, and I usually give a presentation. And this year I'm giving a presentation on the sacred feminine for ideals of the sacred feminine for a sustainable future. And let's see, it's a three-day event. It starts on Friday and the 12th, and it goes Saturday the 13th. What is Gaia Fest all about? Well, at Gaia Fest, we gather to celebrate, send love and healing to Mother Earth, our original mother, through multicultural expressions of music, dance, art, storytelling, ritual, and ceremony. There's going to be an eclectic mix of presenters, musicians, artists, healers, conscious vendors. And it's going to be held at the Fess Parker's Doubletree Resort. And if you're interested in signing up or finding out how much it costs or more details about what's going to happen on that weekend, you can just go to GaiaFestival.com, GaiaFestival.com. And the keynote speaker is Catherine Svela. She's a writer, scholar, and storyteller. And she's brewing up a wonderful workshop called Birthing, Breathing, Thinking, Weaving, Gaia and Grandmother Spider. So it's going to be a lot of fun. Please try to come. I also want to let you know that we have finally now put together a website and have all the details in place for my tour that I'm doing to Turkey next November 2011, so you have lots of time to plan for it. The tour is going to be for men and women, and we're only taking 20 people. It's called On the Trail of the Great Goddess of Anatolia, and Anatolia used to be the name for Turkey, and it actually means nourishing mothers. So we are on the trail of the great goddess in the land of nourishing mothers. We'll be exploring sacred sites during the whole trip. We'll get a sense of the essence of not just Mary, but Isis and Artemis and Hecate and Kabeli and Kubaba and the goddess at Chateau Hayuk. You know, it'd just be a wonderful experience. There aren't many places that you can go where so many crossroads of spirituality and civilization meet in a melting pot like Turkey. So during this, you know, this trip, you not only get to experience the essence and history or herstory of one goddess, but many goddesses. We're going to be doing, you know, wonderful experiential activities and educational things as well as ritual things. You know, there's going to be time to see whirling dervish performances and have a Turkish bath, all sorts of really, you know, fun and educational stuff, things for your left brain and right brain. So if you're being called to make a sacred journey, think about making that one with me and my husband. Also, too, I want to tell you about the Institute for Theology and Theosophy. In the summer of this year, it was founded by a group of scholars and activists. The research center provides scholars and practitioners with a collective political agency to chart new territories within the political, religious, and academic mainstreams that are post-patriarchal in nature, where they are trying to mobilize a discourse that they call theology. The central thesis at the Institute is that theology is a discourse needs to be cultivated, generated, advanced, promoted in the world in order for a post-patriarchal society to become a reality. In her latest book, Restoring the Goddess, Barbara Walker proffers that theology, which regards the voices of the other half of the population, is the solution, the much-needed discourse that has the potential to transform existent hierarchical, social, and political structures. You know, all of this ties in, whether we're talking about the Pope Joan book and the motives for Pope Joan to have gone through her life as a man because of that misogyny, the way women were looked upon then and today, you know, whether we're talking about what Rhian Eisler was talking about, what's good for women is good for the world. Well, this is another example of that. There's so much going on out there that all points in the same direction, you know, to value the feminine, you know, to value women. So anyway, what you might want to do is go to the Institute for Theology and Theosophy, their website. It's www.i4td.org. That's www.i for Institute, for the number four, not the word four, TD. .org. They also have an online, they will be having an online journal called Goddess Theology, an international journal for the study of feminism and religion. And they have actually put out a call for papers. So please go take a look at that if this is the kind of thing you like to read about, maybe submit articles to participate in. The Institute is actually going to be giving a presentation at the American Academy of Religion next year. And So they are definitely very active, and they're new. So you might want to, learn about them on the ground floor and maybe grow with them. Also, too, some of my guests that are coming up in the next few weeks, as October is right around the corner now, we're going to have Vandana Shiva on the show very soon, the author of Water Wars. I'm sure you recognize her name. Also, Sister Joan Chittister, she's known for her controversial claims of women's inequality in the church and her demands for ordination of women. We'll also have Clarissa Pinkola Estes, which you probably recognize her name. She's the author of Women Who Run with the Wolves, Myths and Stories of the Wild Woman Archetype. So lots to look forward to, and those are just a few. So please check out my websites and see who's coming up. Or as I said at the top of the hour, go to my show page and hit the follow me button, and you won't miss a thing. You won't miss a thing. Well, listeners, as we come to a close tonight, I would like to have us focus for just a second. So I invite you to close your eyes and take a deep breath and bring an even deeper focus to, tonight's special words of prayer or intention. We can sort of shake off all the left brain stuff, we've been talking about that is so important. But we're going to go within now and go to that place where we connect with the divine, with our mother, with our sacred self. And what I'd like to read for you is the prayer from the Goddess Temple of Orange County. And it goes like this. Great Mother and Queen of all, I make an open space in my belly to feel the abundance of early autumn and her beauty harvest, which belongs to me and to all life. I receive, receive, receive. Thank you, Mother. Blessed be. Doesn't that feel good? Doesn't that feel so much better than the ideas out there that there just isn't enough to go around? The mother is always about abundance. She is always about making sure we all have abundance and what we need. So I guess with that, I will say good night and thank you for tuning in. And I hope you'll be back with us next Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Pacific. And I guess I will close the show tonight with Arms of the Mother by Abigail Spinner McBride. Please enjoy.
Mama, 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 Mama.